In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Stevens Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's time for your coolest conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock, Little Stevens Underground Garage. I'm the Mighty Manfred. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. I'll be speaking with Mark Valentine, the UK singer-songwriter and frontman of The Last Great Dreamers. This past July saw the release of his debut solo album, Future Obscure, and it features our recent coolest song in the world, Broken Satellites. We'll take a listen to a bit of that now, followed by my chat with Mark on your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Stevens Underground Garage. I'm the Mighty Manfred, and I hope you are ready for our coolest conversations, because on the line with me now is Mark Valentine, singer and songwriter who for many years has fronted the UK band The Last Great Dreamers, and this year released a solo album, Future Obscure, which features our coolest song in the world this week, Broken Satellites. Hey, Mark, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks, Manfred. It's an absolute pleasure to be with you.
Well, thank you for joining me. So, I was looking at this, the bio for The Last Great Dreamers. Says the band began initially as the Silver Hearts back in like 1989, and you formed in London. And what I was wondering was, where are you from originally?
Well, I'm actually from the East Coast, which is where I am right now. The East Coast of England, that is, up near it's a little town called Cromer. The main city's Norwich. Pretty much when I was 18, like every other musician at that time, this is last century, of course, remember, there's no internet, nothing. We just had a couple of music magazines, you know, and that was it, and the radio and TV. You needed to be in the city, really. So I moved to London when I was 18, I think, to get a band together down there. I've been in a band up here, but obviously there's only so much you can do when you're right out in the sticks. So yeah, I moved to London when I was 18, and that's where Silver Hearts began. Probably 1989, I think it was.
89 is what I was reading.
Yeah,
incredible. So you moved down to London.
So you
were playing guitar already, right?
Yeah, well, I'd kind of just been a singer in a band, really. Mm-hmm. So the guitar was sort of a new thing, because I wanted to write more of my own songs at the time, because the band I was in before, there was a few of us writing, and I wanted to sort of have more control over that, and that seemed the best way to do it, is by sort of playing guitar as well.
So you leave home at 18. Was your family supportive of that, or did they think, you know, you'd completely gone bonkers or daft?
Yeah, my mum didn't speak to me for quite a while.
Really?
But yeah, it was difficult, because I was an only child as well. It was difficult for them. So they kind of couldn't quite understand why I'd want to do that. But saying that, my dad was in a band, so in the 60s, and he kind of quit his band to basically become a journalist. So I think he'd always sort of fought with that one himself. So they understood, they were very supportive. And I think the first day they came to visit me, there was a knock on my flat door, and I opened the door, and there was a Marshall JCM 800 out there. So I think pretty much they supported me despite everything else.
Well, what possessed you? I mean, was there any kind of epiphany, or was there some, what was going on in your those teenage years or preteen years to get you wanting to rock your life away?
Yeah, I think it probably, Manfred, a lot of it goes back to my dad, I think, really, because growing up as a kid with probably early 70s, when I first got into music, my dad, like I said, left the band, but he still had a guitar, and he'd play the guitar sort of every week. So on a Sunday, it'd be the showpiece. He'd come out and, you know, do, it was a Rapier. What was it? A Watkins Rapier. He'd plug it into his amp and then do a few, you know, licks and stuff to impress the family. And I guess that kind of stuck with me, watching Top of the Pops, seeing, you know, T-Rex and David Bowie. And at the time, it was just like, you know, it just really, literally just was infused in everything you did. Music was so important. And yeah, I think it all began there, really. I remember sort of the other day I was talking to a friend about early days of recording, what the first thing you recorded was. And I remember having a little Waltham, because, you know, one of those hand carry cassette players. Mm-hmm. I was about seven at the time, and recorded like me playing some biscuit tins and just banging the biscuit tins, singing a terrible melody, and then sort of putting the tape onto another tape player, recording it again, then recording over that again. So basically I was running two machines. I didn't have any idea. I was kind of multi-tracking, I guess, but I didn't really know what I was doing. So in the end, I ended up with this song was about 100 voices of me and about, 200 bins banging away. But yeah, I guess it all began then.
Wow. Well, this is very cool. So this is quite an adventure. You go off to London and you meet these guys, the Silver Hearts, you form, then you wind up morphing into, changing name into the Last Great Dreamers. You guys put out an album in 1994 called Retrosexual.
Yes.
What I'm unclear on is, so that album comes out and maybe you change labels. I think your manager passes away. The band seems to end. But then you reform later on. Can you help me with that timeline? What was going on exactly?
Yeah, there was quite a long hiatus, actually, between those events. With Last Great Dreamers, our album came out. We were sort of nominated for various awards, sort of breaking new bands and stuff, and the Kerrang Awards, things like that. At the time, it just didn't quite happen. You know, the label didn't have the investment that they needed. We were getting some great radio play in Japan, things like that, some good magazine coverage. But the, I guess, Britpop happened at the same time. So although we were poppy, kind of, I guess, glam, but we weren't metal by any means. But it just, the timing was wrong and the kind of things kind of went wrong. We got out of our deal. We about to sign another deal, which was with Fergal Sharkey from the Undertones. Oh. And he was working for, it was Polydor at the time. And it looked like things were going to really take off again. And we kind of reinvented ourselves a bit, as you kind of had to do. It's like you always felt like you were in UK at the time. Yeah, as you know, just changes so quickly. Everything was just moving so fast. Just one week you're in, one week you're out, you know. So I think we all got a bit tired from that. And that deal fell through. And I think we all had to sort of sit back and, you know, realize, We were late 20s, but we thought we were already burnt out, you know, because part of what we were led to believe in those days, that if you hadn't really got your deal sorted by your 28, 29, you were finished, you know. So we all sort of stood back from it and kind of went our separate ways. Just after that, I kept writing. We all did various things, the members. I kept songwriting, and it was about just after that I met my sort of future wife, who's from LA, and eventually ended up in LA for a while, kept songwriting. And I think it was right up until 2013 when I got a call from Slider, the guitarist. I'd lost track with him for many years, and said, you know, if you're back in England, do you fancy sort of doing a reunion as a one-off show? And I wasn't that keen, to be honest, because I thought, well, it's, you know, a lot of time has passed, a lot of water on the bridge. Is anybody even going to be interested, you know? But we did the show, and it was in London, and it was just a one-off at the time, and it just went far better than we expected, and there was a lot of the old fans there, and it kind of, I guess we got that buzz again, and we said, okay, we'll do a couple of things, maybe a couple of shows, and then sort of 2 months, 3 months later, I think we got offered the Cherie Curry tour over here. She came over here first time. She'd been here since the Runaways, and just sort of a lot of things fell into place, and it just kind of all took off. We released our second album that never came out in the 90s, all the stuff we'd recorded for it. And it just sort of, you know, it just sort of happened from there, really. And sort of we did another two albums after that.
In fact, yeah, the most recent one is 2018's 13th Floor Renegades.
Yes.
Is the band still active as you're pursuing this, your solo release here, or is it on a hiatus now?
Yeah, we're on a hiatus. I don't think it will be a 15-year one this time, but at least I hope not, because I'm not sure where I'll be in that. But we've just taken a hiatus. It kind of, the pandemic kind of slowed us down, you know, and as it did with many other artists, kind of was a difficult challenge for all of us. We'd been pretty much been touring nonstop. We just put out the Renegades album, and it also, I'd had some illness as well at the time, and the pandemic happened, and because none of us live in, we're not in London anymore, you know, back in the day, we all lived around the corner from each other, and we slept on each other's floors, and it was so easy to be in a band. Now we kind of all live 200-300 miles apart. The pandemic really did sort of change things instantly for us. So we decided to take some time out for various other reasons as well. And Slide, the guitarist, wanted to work on some stuff, some solo stuff he had in mind, and same for me.
Okay. So had this wanting to work on some solo stuff, was an idea that had been percolating for a while, or did this go ahead.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. I think everyone probably has that inside them somewhere. Perhaps they might be in denial of it at some point, but I think everybody kind of wants to have that little bit of time out to perhaps be a little bit more personal with their work, you know, if they have the opportunity. And it's obviously not meant as any detriment to the band they might be in, but it's just obviously a slightly different angle. And it seemed like the opportunity at that point of the pandemic, you know, I don't know what it was like. We in LA, obviously I've still got family there and everything, but here I'm really out in the country, and it was deadly quiet. There was nothing going on. All my children were here, the homeschooling, everything. The house was packed with people. But it did seem, I'd go to my shed. Basically, I had to move all my equipment out into my shed, because it was the only place really there wasn't somebody. And had to get rid of the rats that were in there. The rats had moved in, unfortunately, but the rats had actually eaten their way through the floor during the winter. They'd actually eaten through wood, the rats.
Wow.
And they'd made a nest from, sorry, I'm digressing a little bit here. They made a nest from these old Barbie dresses and stuff, and they'd chewed up some of my old LA weeklies, and it all fused with their urine and feces and everything, and made this weird nest. And it was the strangest thing I've ever seen, but obviously I had to get rid of all that.
How delightful. It's kind of like you had this captive audience in there, and their rat nest amphitheater.
I could have been the Rat King by now if I'd only thought of that one. Yeah. Oh, dear. Yeah.
Well, I was wondering, you mentioned the guitar player, Slider, when you were active as the Last Great Dreamers, did you guys co-write a lot together?
Yeah, we wrote with our last two albums. Usually what we do, we get together in a rehearsal studio, play through our ideas, sort of jam them together, sort of bounce off each other, and sort of compile the album that way, and then take it to the rest of the boys, or the bass and drums, and then sort of do the arrangements, and then hit the studio after that.
Well,
with the solo stuff.
On the solo album, on Future Obscure, these are all your own compositions?
Yes, yeah, they're all mine. I did have a few collaborators, if you look through it, who I co-wrote with or get writing credit. Reckless Eric, right, and Matt Dangerfield from The Boys.
Right.
Reckless Eric, you're probably familiar with him. He turns out he lives only 2 miles away from me, and we actually became good friends over the last few years. And yeah, I said, have you got some time, Eric? Would you like to be involved with a couple of tracks? And he was up for it.
So
it was great.
The track
is
Death is Overrated, right?
Death is Overrated.
Yeah.
And there's another track called Linear Slopes as well, which he played quite a lot on Linear Slopes. That's probably got more of his his footprint on it. And we did some pretty crazy stuff on there. So we recorded a lot.
Well, so in the video with Death is Overrated towards the end, you guys are doing a bit of dancing together.
Yeah.
Is he a good dancer?
Eric, he's got the moves. I mean, I would not deny the man has got the moves.
He was leading then.
He was leading, of course. always lead, as you can tell. It was a bit slippery, so we did have to hold hands for a while. Was our excuse anyway.
Well, Pete, really cool. He's you guys out there on the beach there, and he said the Keys and the ocean or whatever is coming in, and it's like, I don't know if his feet are going to get wet there.
Yeah, his toes did get a little bit damp, and bless him, but it's absolutely brilliant. Yeah, he's such a good fun, Eric, and he's an amazing guy and still an incredible songwriter. The output is amazing, and he never ceases to amaze me with the things, the songs that he comes up with, and just very inventive and very organic how he works. Certainly a lot of the sounds and things, literally it's incredible. Yeah, and somebody I really highly respect.
Well, let's talk some more about the album. So we're familiar with Dave Draper here in the Underground Garage,
yes,
from his work with Ryan Hamilton and Ginger Wildheart.
Yep.
So how did you wind up coming to work with Dave?
Yeah, well, that was another sort of stroke of luck, really. It was during the pandemic. I had started recording my album, and I had started recording with another producer, or started working on some rough mixes. Then there was some bad luck, actually. I suffered a medical injury during that time, and also my mother sadly passed away. And I had to put the recording on hold for quite some time. In fact, I didn't actually know if I would actually finish the album at this point. Things had got that bad. So I actually had a hiatus within a hiatus, if you understand.
Right.
And a few things sort of fell just after this period. I'd sort of recovered somewhat, and a few things fell into place. And I think somebody put me in touch with Dave, and this is at the same time I spoke with Eric and with Matt Dangerfield. And I'd always admired Dave's work. And I think when we had a chat and everything, I realized, oh gosh, perhaps this has happened for a reason, that I'm supposed to actually do this with Dave, this album. And it all came together really, really quickly after that. And I'm just so lucky that it did, to be honest, Manfred. And it's just, Dave's, as he's got such a great body of work. And again, somebody is just so exciting to work with.
Right.
And I'm really grateful for everything he's done with the record.
So all these tracks, 12 tracks on the album, were they all recorded at the same session?
We kind of pretty much... different sessions over a period of time. We obviously mixed it all together and produced it in the last all together. In fact, the first person to hear it actually was Ginger Wildheart. He actually came into the studio to start his session just as we were finishing the last mix. So it was a nice little tie-in, actually.
And in fact, I want to ask you about Ginger in a moment, because I know you've been playing some shows with him.
Yes,
I recognize that on the... The liner notes I have for who's playing on Broken Satellites, I noticed Denley Slade's name, who I believe I saw played at some point plays in The Last Great Dreamers, the drummer.
Yep. Yep.
Do any of the other guys backing you on the recording, or other members of The Last Great Dreamers behind you?
Yes. I've got the Denley played on two of the Dreamers albums, and also Steve Fielding, who played bass. So these two guys come out with me live as well. So all the shows I've done, they've been with me, and they're amazing rhythm sections. So yeah, I'm very grateful and lucky to have those guys with me, that's well spotted, actually. Yeah.
Well, our coolest song in the world this week is Broken Satellites. Now, the liner notes I have for this list, the guitar, bass, and drums, but there's production has got a lot more going on than just that. Those other touches, yes, the keys, et cetera, are those Dave's suggestions or those things that you guys thought up together?
Well, the keys kind of, when I wrote the song, it was kind of, I had that in mind. I actually started that one in the shed with my son. Yeah, with the rats and my son, Kobe. We're both huge Springsteen fans, and kind of the vibe we were going for at the time with obviously the piano was so essential. And my son, Kobe, played the piano on that track, actually.
Oh, wow. How old is Kobe?
He's now, I guess at the time he was 18.
Yeah.
So he's 20 now. Yeah.
What was the creative spark, inspiration for Broken Satellites?
Well, you probably hear there's a not too bad lands there. When I was writing the album, I was obviously reflecting on a lot of things in life. I think as we probably all did during the pandemic, and was just pulling up a lot of stories and previous things that places I'd been during my life. And I think there's a lot of reflection going on at the time. I was in my shed. It was deathly quiet outside. There was nothing, you know, because I live in the middle of nowhere, so there was no traffic, just the birds and a little bit of wind. And I think that gave space, it created the space around me, and sort of brought out some sort of deeper sort of memories and feelings. And I think that's how it really came together, that song. And it was just one that kind of, you know, I knew we needed to get on the record. So
you mentioned your wife being from Los Angeles, and of course that makes sense to me. I also found something about you living in Los Angeles. I can't remember which sort of bio led me to that. And before I read that, though, on the album, there here and there a couple of words about LA, which had me thinking, what? What's going on? So when exactly were you in Los Angeles?
Right. Okay. I was first out there in 99. I stayed out there 2000 for about 6-7 months with Billy when I first met her. And then I came back, and then we moved out there, I think in 2003, just after our, 2004. And I think I was out there until about 2012 on and off. So yeah, I'm actually a US citizen. So,
Well, Mark, we may have passed each other on the street and not
we
even.
We may well have done. It's about what you're bound to. I lived in ended up in the valleys where I ended up in Downing. Oh, okay. So, I sort of started in North Hollywood and then it ended up near Ventura right at the end. So, I've been around a bit. I love LA, and it's had a huge influence over me.
Well, that's great. So, what do you love about LA?
Well, it's just so much. Obviously the climate goes without saying, the love of music there, I think, is just so real. You know, it's just intrinsically part of everybody's life still. When the first time I went there, you're switching on the radio and there's like, wow, every channel's playing great tunes, you know. And it's just, it doesn't never happened here, you know. You didn't, you know, Chaos 101, we didn't have anything like that. K-Rock, we didn't have anything like that here, really. And it was just, I think it was the, I know it sounds like cliches, but the positive attitude, just so many things, the climate, like I say, the food, and of course the family that I made there, and friends. I already had some, you know, a couple of friends out there already. So, so many different things, aspects. I do miss it terribly because I've not been for a few years. So I'm hoping to make up for that next year.
Sure. But what took you back to the UK?
Well, we did come back. So at the time, my mother wasn't well, so we needed to come back to tell my mum and my dad. And as things go, you know, we have children, and we ended up staying perhaps a little longer than we expected. And here we are now, obviously, since my mum's passed away. So, I think, I don't know where we'll end up eventually, but you know, it's still a big place in my heart. And I know we'll be back to LA for sure.
Oh, great. Well, you know, we mentioned, talked a little bit about Reckless Eric, but also on the album, you were working with Matt Dangerfield from The Boys, right?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, and that is that track, Mornington Avenue, is that like a tribute song to The Boys?
No, it's interesting because they obviously have similar connections. It's based in Camden, or based around Camden, that song.
In fact, you'll have to explain to me what is the why does Mornington Avenue, what's the resonance of that? What?
Yeah, right. Okay. Well, if you look on the A to Z or a tube map, there's a station called Mornington Crescent. That's where I used to live. That's where we started the band, which is, it's just outside Camden, or it's part of Camden. The tube station is called Mornington Crescent, and there's a little road called Mornington Crescent, which is where I lived in a bedsit there. But of course, I couldn't fit Crescent into the song. It just didn't sound right, so I changed the poetic license. I changed it to Avenue.
Absolutely.
Everybody's looking on the map. There's no bloody Mornington Avenue in London. I can't find the bloody place. Yeah. But of course, it's Mornington Crescent, loosely. And yeah, that's kind of the memories from that time, starting out in the naivety that we had, and, you know, thinking that you could change the whole world. And it's just such an amazing feeling when you get your first band together and, you know, and you want to take on the world. It's just, there's nothing like it.
Well, how does that tie into the boys and Matt Dangerfield?
Well, with Matt, I'd done some shows with the boys before, and brilliant band as well, and I'd spoke to Matt and I said, you know, would you be interested in you know featuring on a track on the album? I've got a couple of collaborators, I'd love you to be on it, and I think this track, you know, would have, you know, have some resonance. And he said yeah, and he sort of wrote the riff for it, and it was just perfect, the melody and everything. And it has turned into one of the fans' favorites on the album. So and we filmed the video in Camden as well, so it's kind of cool.
Very cool. So also another song I wanted to ask you about is Zodiac Hotel. Was that a real place?
You've been there, haven't you? Yeah. Just the one it was.
Well, spiritually, I think I probably checked. Yeah. I think my Zodiac Hotel was somewhere in Germany, but it was...
right. Yeah, I think everybody's got one. I've got one in Wolverhampton. It's always that place you don't want to be, that... Obviously, the world's coming to an end, and there's just no escape from it. It's just when everything goes wrong, that's the place you're at, you know. And I think it's just kind of, you know, it's with many of the songs I write, there's a lot of darkness, but there's also a little bit of hope in it. You know, there might be desperation, there might be, you know, some despair, but there's always a little bit of hope. And obviously, you know, you've always got to somehow see the positive in things, and you know, sometimes. Not take yourself too seriously, but the Zodiac Hotel, yeah, it's just that was a song that happened very quickly, and does mention LA in it as well, of course.
That's what I thought. I was thinking, was that one of them? You mentioned when you were in the studio there that I guess Ginger Wildheart dropped by, or maybe he was just finishing a session as you were starting, or is it the other way around? You're just
the other way around.
Yeah, the other way around. So had you known him before? Had you both chosen? Okay.
Yes, yeah, I from the Wild Hearts, we've done a couple of shows with Ginger and the Wild Hearts before, and you know, phenomenal band. I mean, he's an amazing songwriter, probably from, you know, the UK. I don't think we've ever seen anyone of his the likes of him, you know, because he's just so prolific. It's incredible, and tune after tune after tune, and yeah, he's an amazing guy, and he's always, you know, giving me advice and help me out when he can. He's been brilliant, and obviously working with Dave Draper as well, and he's just wonderful. And
so you guys did some shows recently touring with with the Sinners, Wild Heart and the Sinners,
yeah, who are, as you guys know, amazing amazing band on Wicked Cool. A great bunch of chaps as well, really lovely guys, and the musicianship is just, well, second to none. The harmonies are incredible live. I mean, we got to see them every night, so it was brilliant. And
how many shows did you guys do together?
We've done four with them all together. So three last week. Yeah. They are a really awesome band. I hope we could do some more shows together again in the future.
Do you think it'll play out any more before the end of the year?
Me personally.
Yeah.
I do have three other shows planned. I have one in London in November and one in Brighton with a UK band called the Speedways, a sort of power pop band. They're a really good band as well. And then at the end of the year, doing the Christmas, the Evil Rock magazine, Christmas party. There's a few good bands on there as well. So yes, I'm hoping for next year. I've just had a couple of, festival confirmations this week, and I'll be back with Dave Draper next week as well. So we've started work on the next album, which I think is going to be another step up on by the sounds of it. So really, really excited about that.
Well, all this sounds really great. And you're going to add to that your triumphant return to Los Angeles, where you'll be performing.
Yes, I hope so. Yeah, I don't have a problem, I say, with my citizenship, so I can carry a guitar. So I know it's really, really difficult for British musicians to get to the States. It's so, so hard. But yeah, I'd like to think, you know, I will definitely get out there in musical capacity sooner than later, I hope.
Well, let's talk about one more cut. The album opens up with the track Last Train Tonight, and you've done a video for that as well. And there's a couple of middle-aged toughs kind of roughing you up in this video. Is middle-aged hooliganism a problem these days across the UK?
Well, you know, they're all scallywags, whether they're 5 years old or 50 years old. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, never go out on your own at night, especially if you're wearing eyeliner. So, I think the cost of living crisis we've got now, we're going to see a bit more of this, unfortunately, as we get into the winter. But no, seriously, it's just a bit of fun. But we've all been there where we've been on the wrong side of town or the wrong side of the tracks and only just made it home, you know. That's happened a few times. And yeah.
And so did the when you came up with that song, did you actually happen to be on a train when the idea popped into you?
I think when the last time I'd got beaten up, I actually wasn't on a train. I was trying to get into a car, actually, but I couldn't actually get into the car because the two fellas sort of duffed me up. But this a few years ago. But I thought I'd like the kind of sort of the desperate appeal of, you know, you've got to try and somehow you'll get home, whatever happens, however messed up you get, whoever tries to stop you, you'll make it home. And the last train is always kind of sort of symbolic of those crazy nights that we've all been at, you know.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for speaking with me on our Coolest Conversations.
Thank you so much, man. It's been lovely being there. Thank you so much.
Well, right now, here's Last Train Tonight off his solo album, Future Obscure. It's Mark Valentine and Little Stevens, Underground Garage. With some of Last Train Tonight, that was Mark Valentine here in Little Stevens Underground Garage. The song is part of his debut solo album, Future Obscure. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to Mark for joining me on today's Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza for producing our podcast. Dennis Tech is a singer, songwriter, guitarist who is the founding member of the seminal Australian punk band Radio Birdman. He's had lots of other projects since, including a recent collaboration with James Williamson of the Stooges, and earlier this year saw the release of his most recent solo album, Long Before Day. He's my guest next time around on your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock, here in Little Stevens Underground Garage.
Buddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise playing in the street. I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.